You're listening to Radio Free Thinker, episode 93.
Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone, old Constantinople. Still it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
Take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
And welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Dylan, your political science philosopher.
This is Chloe. I just got out of an exam, so I feel like I've just been through a meat grinder.
And this is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club, and about to enter the meat grinder after this.
That's funny. I don't miss being a student. So how are you all people doing?
I'm stunned and amazed. Stunned and amazed. Apparently one of the most foundational objects of Canadian culture is in risk of being destroyed. Apparently the Senate is saying that we should get rid of our penny.
About time.
I just don't know what to do. What are we going to do without these little coppery things in our pockets that we never spend, we never use, but we collect? You know, I'm beside myself.
I'd be okay if they just made a 99-cent penny. If I could just carry on that, I would be happy.
But that doesn't work either, right? Because, I mean, anything that's 99 cents doesn't include tax.
So 99 cents plus tax.
Yeah. So that penny. I was surprised to find out that, what is it? Is it 1.5 cents... to make a penny. Mm-hmm. Australia, apparently, and New Zealand don't have pennies. And apparently the mint is kind of upset about pennies because they have to make a lot more pennies than they really should be because nobody spends them, so they get hoarded, which means they get taken out of the economy, so they need to keep making more pennies to replace the ones that kind of get thrown in the garbage or what have you.
Mm. Which is why pennies are just stupid.
You know what isn't stupid? Istanbul.
No, Istanbul is not stupid.
That's right. It's a very fun place. I've never been there, but I hear.
I heard Constantinople was funner.
Well, see, that's the big question. The song that we opened with, one of my personal favorite songs of all time, because it refers to two fantastic cities, Istanbul and Constantinople.
But wait, aren't those the same city?
Well, you see, the thing is, not many people realize why Constantinople became Istanbul. I will now reveal the answer. Live on radio. You see, Istanbul is an amalgamation of a phrase that the Greeks had that meant look to the city. You see, as the Byzantium Empire was slowly collapsing and everything looked like it was going to crap, they would say, well, look to the city, look to Constantinople, this shining jewel of a city. And they kept saying it over and over and over again that Istanbul became the name of Constantinople.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Is there documentary evidence, citation needed here?
Well, you can always ask, I don't know, maybe the American Anthropological Association.
Don't you mean the Anthropological Science Association?
Well, unfortunately not. Some science-loving anthropologists have been enraged recently now that the AAA, as I'm going to call them, have stripped the word science from its long-range plan. Can you believe that? Science.
You know, so the long-range plan is to just not science?
Well, no, it's science.
No, I thought it dealt. It used to be called the Anthropological Science Society, and they thought the acronym was just not good, so they didn't.
Yeah. So this has caused a lot of debate amongst the different branches of anthropology, because there's actually different schools of thought here. There's sort of the science-based aspects, sort of the anthropological disciplines, archaeology, physical anthropology, forensic anthropology. Then there's more sort of the humanities branch, which focuses on things like race and ethnicity, gender, culture, that sort of thing.
Almost like historical sociology. Not exactly like that.
No, it's a little like that. But
similar,
you know,
kind of thing.
So the new plan has changed from, this is what the old slogan used to be, to advance anthropology as a science that studies humankind in all its aspects. I like that. It now reads, the purpose of the association shall be to advance public understanding of humankind in all its aspects. They've also dropped the word science from two other places in the new revised statement.
Well, at least hopefully they're not going for some new agey sort of angle on this to somehow, you know, make it more natural or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing is, after they did this, they really got in trouble with their members and science reporters all over the world, so much so that they actually had to release a revised statement, and they wanted to underline the fact that they understand the crucial place of the scientific method in much of anthropological research. The statement defined anthropology as a holistic and expansive discipline that covers the full breadth of human history and culture. Anthropology draws on the methods of both the humanities and the sciences. And then Damon Deuser, the association's director of public affairs, also mentioned, we mean holistic in terms of diversity of discipline. I assume not in terms of woo-woo.
Well, yeah. And I'm sure he said, you know, and I know this because I was channeling a 13,000-year-old. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
See, this holistic way doesn't have to be a bad word.
No.
Doesn't have to be.
But it usually is.
Yeah.
This raises a really interesting question, I think, which is, can we approach the humanities from the humanities from a scientific point of view? And I would say that we could. It's just difficult.
It's difficult. It's not impossible. I mean, it really depends on what you're looking at. There are certain times when you're going to be making judgment calls, basically. But other times when you're actually looking at hard data, and in those cases, I think science is your ally. I mean, it's also useful in the fact that the method can be transitioned from science to other things. I mean, on this show, we're constantly talking about taking skepticism beyond just science and applying it to other things. There's really no reason why you wouldn't do that in this case as well.
I think one of the things that people feel uncomfortable when they try and use the scientific method in non-science areas is you lose a lot of the certainty that you can get with it. But just because you don't have, like, you know, decimal point precision doesn't mean you can't get better precision using those methods, even if they are a bit fuzzier, but they still help, you know, focus the views, the ideas, and, you know, order what is a more plausible versus less plausible hypothesis.
I mean, this case is kind of disappointing because this has actually highlighted an already very tense situation within the field of anthropology. There's a good deal of, I'd say, strife and tension, actually. I mean, after all, these are people who are trying to get funding for their research, or trying to get their faculties at university, you know, students and grad students, and they don't really need the added difficulty of trying to defend their field's integrity. So, I mean, it might actually be too late to head off a major schism in the field of anthropology, but perhaps, you know, with some more carefully worded press releases, the AAA can head this off.
Well, I think we're being a little unfair here. It's important to mention that there are lots of anthropologists who supported this. That's why it happened in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, some of them do indeed support this. I mean, I think they're more on the humanities side than they are on the science side.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of funny because some of the articles I was reading didn't directly compare this, but mentioned humanism a lot. And that was one of the big issues when the free thought movement was first starting, is this quote-unquote marriage of skepticism and humanism, which a lot of people kind of felt was just not proper. But, I mean, kind of an interesting situation here with anthropology. But what else is making news in the skeptical world?
Well, not so much skeptical world, although some people are quite skeptical. We did an episode a while ago about the G20 and the whole kerfuffle that went around the police actions. Well, apparently Ontario's ombudsman called Andre Martin has released a report entitled Caught in the Act, which is both punny and somewhat telling about what he says. He says, and I quote, "For the citizens of Toronto, the day up to and including the weekend of the G8/G20 will live in infamy as a time period where martial law set in the city, leading to the most massive compromise of civil liberties in Canadian history. And we can never let this happen again."
Did his voice actually change like that?
No. And, I mean, actually, I like what he says in this, but I don't know if it's a day that will live in infamy. It's somehow that you need Pearl Harbor style thing for that word to be used these days. But he was making reference to the Liberal government, Ontario Liberal governments, enacting regulation 233/10, which gave the police, and again, quote, "phenomenal powers." It passed without debate. It was part of the Public Works Protection Act. Now, this act was initially set up in 1939 to protect the infrastructure from the Nazis. So some people have said, you know, this is a bit of an overkill, and, well, this does kind of lead to
it. Were the Nazis actually going after our infrastructure? I don't remember anything.
Well, there was always the risk of fifth columns, right? It's a bit of a stretch, but not a huge bit of a stretch. But apparently the law in itself actually only extended the territory. So public facilities, you know, power stations, all that, were covered under the law beforehand. But, and according to the ombudsman, there's only three small parts in the security perimeter that weren't considered to be public territory that qualified for this law. And that's why this was passed to do this. Now, apparently, you know, as we've said before, anyone who is in the security area had to provide identification of who they were and explain why they were there. And penalties included up to 2 months in jail or $500 fine. Now, the police took or interpreted this law to mean anyone who was near the fence. So it wasn't just inside the perimeter, but even near the perimeter, which apparently even when it was brought into the police chief's attention that this, it was called the 5-meter rule, right? So if you're within, or 5-foot rule, if you're within 5 feet, they could do this. Even when it was, he still continued to do it. And he said that he was just trying to keep the criminals out. So he acknowledged that he was sort of breaking his own law. The ombudsman also made another interesting point that I thought was interesting. He says that a lot of responsible protesters and civil rights group who took the trouble to educate themselves about their rights prior to the G20 had no way of knowing that they were literally walking into a trap. They were literally caught in the act, the title, an act of public entrapment. Because again, if you read the law, you knew if you were in the zone, they were going to want this. But if you're outside the zone, you were safe. So you'd set up your protest as close as you can, because that's the whole point of protesting, is to get as close as you can. But that was the kicker. If you were close, then they were going to get you because they were misinterpreting their own law. Mm-hmm. He also commented, and he found this probably the most disturbing, is that he received zero cooperation from the armed the security forces, the police and all that, in doing this, which, again, apparently is not really a precedented thing. Usually they're relatively cooperative. So, it looks like all our fear-mongering about the G20 was somewhat well-placed. Fortunately, we do have an ombudsman who's doing this. Although, another thing, that police spokesman came out and said that a lot of these incidences were based on anecdotal evidence, right? A lot of the stuff he used for this report was based on anecdotal evidence, which I might agree to a degree, because, I mean, first of all, what happened to you? Oh, well, this happened to me. Well, that's anecdotal. But I don't know if you guys remember, but, I mean, wasn't, like, the CBC News showing that over 1,000 people were arrested? Mm-hmm. I mean, doesn't that qualify as quantifiable evidence that this was somehow...
And even if there's enough anecdotal evidence that can be backed up by other people who saw what happened and all that stuff, it does eventually reach a part where you can be fairly sure. If it's just one person coming out, well, be iffy. If it's 10 people and they're all, like, members of the same group, be iffy. But when it's thousands of people in a very diverse group, then...
Well, careful. I mean, that's what UFOologists would say.
I was going to jump on this because you're right, because we often talk about anecdotal evidence, but the anecdotal evidence you're talking about, Ethan, goes against empirical evidence, right, mm-hmm. goes against. So it's not that the anecdotal evidence in itself is necessarily useless, but anecdotal evidence, when it conflicts with empirical evidence, suddenly loses a lot of its weight. So this pill makes me feel better, therefore it must have a therapeutic effect. And when you look at it and we test it in double-blind studies, and no, it doesn't, then the anecdotal evidence becomes worthless.
Yeah,
right?
And I also mean to say that it's backed up by what journalists saw, what people who weren't even there protesting saw. Mm. There were people who didn't even agree with the protesters who either got arbitrarily searched or even I've heard, I think, one arrest of someone who just happened to be walking by. And so it's pretty clear that it's not just a bunch of people who already hated the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the police chief himself initially said that there was this 5-meter rule. He corrected himself later on. So, I mean, I guess his thing is anecdotal evidence, too. Well, I said it, but you can't prove it.
Yeah. Were you on camera?
This is also so clearly against the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which protects people against arbitrary search and seizure. Mm-hmm. And protected in that, search doesn't just include physical search of belongings on you, but it also protects you from sort of interrogational search. So police asking you what you're doing, why you have certain things. They aren't allowed to arbitrarily do that. If you ever get pulled over by a police officer, they can only ask you things pertinent to why they pulled you over. Say you had like a wad of cash sitting in your car or something, they're like, why did you have that cash? Do you just do drug deals? You don't have to answer. You don't have to answer anything.
Yeah, they can ask you. They can't use that as grounds for like, you know, oh, that wad of cash.
But it sounded like the way this law was worded is that they were given basically a law that says people had to answer it or else they could arrest them.
Right. Well, why don't we take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with some more after this.
I'm Walter Cronkite. I'd like you to hear something.
Any way you want it, that's the way you need it. Any way you want it.
They're radio hams, amateurs, giving of their own time and spending their own money.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Your volunteer-run station.
They're just two average guys who saw the need and volunteered.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. So what else is you know, kind of in the news or something?
Well, you know, we're going to talk about something that's been in the news, but we're going to use a phrase that I learned from a database teacher of mine. We're going to go to Grandma's house first, but there is a purpose to do this. So we're going to go to Grandma's house to go here.
Can you explain that saying quickly?
Well, instead of going directly, you take a bit of a detour. And the detour is important in this particular case. So this might be interesting to start off with. So everyone knows about WikiLeaks. Of course, everything has been focused on Julian Assange. But there have been some interesting revelations that have come out of it. We're not going to talk too much about that this week. But one thing was about how the American government put pressure on the German government to put pressure on its judiciary to squash some subpoenas for some CIA agents who apparently mistakenly... extraordinarily renditioned. Can I invent that word?
No, that's a real term.
Really?
Extraordinary rendition? There was a movie.
Renditioned.
About it. Oh, rendition.
As a verb.
No, you're just verbing it.
a German citizen named Khalid al-Masari, thinking that he was Khalid al-Masari, difference being one spelled with an E and the other one spelled with an A. So they took the guy, they took him to Afghanistan where they tortured him, they gave him drugs, they starved him, you know, to get him out. Eventually they realized, oops, we've got the wrong guy. Then their attitude was, whoops, now he knows too much, so we can't release him. And then from the WikiLeaks cable, it came out that Condoleezza Rice had to personally intervene to get this guy released twice, because she ordered it once, and then they ignored it, so she ordered it again and got him out. So we have the American government putting pressure on the German government to do judiciary things. We also find out in the WikiLeaks that the United States government was also collaborating with Spanish prosecutors in order to get a Judge Gonzola sort of disbarred or put aside because, one, this judge was trying to get an arrest warrant on what was known as the Bush Six, six senior Bush administrators, including Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The judge himself is quite famous for putting on an arrest warrant for Pinochet, for torture, and for crimes against humanity. So he has a record about it. So here we have two very important cases where the American government put pressure on a foreign government's judiciary, which is supposed to be separate and all that, in order to get them to do things. Now that we've gone to grandma's house, Julian Assange was accused of raping two women in Sweden. The women went to the attorney general in Sweden, and he said, no, you don't really have a case, and threw it away. Then more WikiLeaks stuff came out, and suddenly they're saying, hey, we've got these things on here, and they're attempting to charge him with something. Of course, right now the whole thing is that they want him for questioning with regards to the possibility of charging him for rape or sexual molestation. It's a little confusing what they want him for, but we have this American interference. I'm just saying that some people say this is a conspiracy. And maybe it is, because one of the things that came out of the WikiLeaks is that the American government has used its political pressure to do this. So it's really bizarre, because he hasn't been charged with anything. And ironically enough, they haven't allowed him bail. The British government didn't originally allow him bail. And the Assange's legal team says, well, you know, the only way you can do that is if he was charged with an extraditable offense, then you might not give him bail. And it says that, you know, if Sweden doesn't even think it has enough evidence to actually charge him with anything, how can the British government deny him bail? Now, at last word, I had heard that he had got his bail. Set at something like, what, £240,000, surrender his passport, he's got to show up to cops once a day, and he's got one of those little electronic cufflinks that, you know, say where he is, and he's got a curfew. Although I hear that might have actually been squashed as well.
Yeah, it looks like Swedish courts are trying to stop him from getting bail out of fear that he'll disappear, run away. I don't know if that's actually going to work out in the end. I assume he'll probably get bail, but they're doing their best to at least stop it.
That was another funny thing. One of the articles that I read had mentioned that, you know, how is he really going to disappear? I mean, he's probably right now the most recognized person on the face of the earth. I mean, he was voted the Times Man of the Year by a popular vote. It's not their official vote, right? Even actually, there's this one quote I found from a Kristen Axelson, who is in Britain. She's a spokesperson for Women Against Rape. And she said it was routine for people charged with rape in the UK to be granted bail. Assange is yet to be formally charged by the Swedes. She also says that Sweden has a poor record of bringing rapists to justice. Right? Okay, I'm misquoting that slightly somehow. But she also quoted, there's a long tradition of using rape and sexual assault for political agendas that have nothing to do with women's safety. Now, this is a woman who is responsible for, you know, women against rape. So it's a very, very interesting juxtaposition. I also found out, again, trying to figure out what has he actually been accused of. Apparently in Sweden, which is actually known by themselves as being a very pro-feminist country, they have at least three kinds of rape. They have severe rape, which is like really violent and has a, you know, it's frowned upon, obviously, the most. They have regular rape, which just strikes me as an odd way of putting it, where it's got a little violence. And then the third one is where you have non-consensual sex, but no force has been really applied or whatever. And from what I said, this may be actually one of the ones that Assange might be involved in. One of the reports I said that he had sort of a morning quickie and the other person may not have been awake, so couldn't have given consent.
One article I read called it Sex by Surprise.
And there's a lot of things, too, about, you know, well, so it's really murky about his charges to begin with. If he is a rapist, I mean, he should be charged. But what that has to do with the WikiLeaks in itself, because these two things have been so intertwined, it struck me as really, really bizarre.
It's important to point out, though, that Sweden has yet to provide a consistent reason that he should be extradited to them. They've sort of waffled over what exactly they're charging him with, and the stories of the people who are charging him don't fully make sense. For instance, one of them said that she kept trying to call Assange after the supposed incident, but he would never answered, but then later said something else about how she talked to him after. So there's all these weird little things that make you question the veracity of the claims.
I smell conspiracy theory. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I rarely do, and this really feels quite contrived to me.
This Women Against Rape spokesman also said that many women in both Sweden and Britain are wondering at the unusual zeal with which Julian Assange is being pursued for these rape allegations. You know, so, but, you know, this is all still smoke, right? Like I say, he may be a horrible person, but, you know, I mean, our own, former aide to Harper called for, quote unquote, jokingly, for the assassination of Julian Assange and... You know, it's so the whole
and many U.S. politicians have said the exact same thing,
which is
they probably mean it with a little more zeal.
Yeah. which strikes me as another bizarre thing about all this is that, you know, I mean, everyone says, "Oh, WikiLeaks is horrible because it's publishing all this thing." Well, so is Der Spiegel, so is The Guardian, indirectly, so is the New York Times, and no one has said that these places should be shut down. In fact, I even found a link to an American government site that has some of these documents posted as. I forget exactly the reason why, but they're up there, and it just strikes me as bizarre.
Well, I mean, it's also the improperness of making comments like that on a case that is pending. This is one of the reasons why people try to keep this sort of stuff quiet, is because you can color the lens that you see this person through when you have politicians saying, oh, yeah, this guy should be assassinated. You know, that kind of creates this false image that he's this horrible person. He hasn't even gone to trial yet.
No. No, and, you know, like I say, we're probably going to do much more into the actual WikiLeaks in themselves, but this whole thing about Assange and how he's become the center of the story.
In many ways, it's annoying because the center of the story should be the documents, not this guy.
Or even, if you wanted to stretch the issue, the private who apparently was the one responsible for actually taking the documents off base, right? Because, I mean, if anyone has done anything technically wrong, he's the one who actually did the deed.
Right.
What has become of him? He was in the...
I understand he's enjoying a vacation in Cuba.
Oh.
Well, let's take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back with more after this.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind. He can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, for instance, I'm walking along. And I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Mm, yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're going to be talking a bit about land ownership. That's an odd segue, but that's what we're doing, so live with it.
Actually, no, here's the good segue. So we were talking about Assange and how what country should he be in. Well, that leads you to an interesting question. What exactly defines a country, and when are you in one, and when aren't you in one?
I like mine better.
Yeah.
Anyway, so land. Now, this came up to me because I've been reading a lot about various issues about land claims and international borders, very fascinating material. So I wanted to discuss, how do we determine who owns land and who has the right to it? And then there's a lot of important issues that sort of depend on this question. One of them that I mentioned, native land claims, for instance. Not just that, but also international borders, occupation, sort of war zones. I mean, some people would consider Israel to be an issue of occupation, but also property rights, who owns something, when you own it, how do you determine it. And there are a lot of, I think, completely irrational arguments being made for why somebody owns or doesn't own a piece of land.
I think we all agree. Next topic.
Okay, thanks. So these arguments, they usually have a hierarchy about them, and they kind of all relate to each other. So it's kind of interesting to see how they go. The first one that we often hear is sort of, our ancestors lived here first. It's sort of like, finders keepers, but with your grandparents.
But even that one has some issues. I mean, most of the anthropologists now believe there's been at least two, maybe three, four immigrations into the New World, right? I mean, there was the Clovis people, then there are what we call the First Nations people, and then there are the European people, and there may have actually been one before the Clovis people came here. So, I mean, who then, has the right?
Well, exactly. And this sort of argument that goes along with it is that a chunk of land or whatever belongs to one group of people because that group of people's ancestors lived there. They're saying that land can be inherited. But the question is, well, how do you determine the ancestry then? I mean, all humans share a common ancestry if you go back far enough.
We are all African.
That's true.
It says so on Ethan's shirt.
It does say that. In addition, how do you determine sufficient ancestry? For example, is it enough if a descendant had, say, one parent from the group, but one parent came from outside the group? Is that sufficient ancestry? What if both parents are from the in-group, but one of his grandparents is from the out-group?
And what if God tells you it's your land?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Well,
supernatural into this.
And actually, you can have a great thing, because what if one of your ancestors was European, one of them was what we call African. What if one of them was Native American? One of them was Aboriginal. Does that mean you own the world?
All the land is yours.
Yes. Well, I mean that's a pretty important issue that needs to be addressed here. Sort of the next stage of this argument, or in some cases either its beginning or its ultimate conclusion, is, well, we were there first. And it's sort of, well, our ancestors were there first, or we were there first, depending on the situation. We either have inherited or were the ones who were using the land. And again, the problem with this one is that the further back in time you go, the more ancestors humans have. So 10,000 years ago, when North America was settled by, say, the Clovis people, sure, they're direct ancestors of modern-day First Nations people, but they're also ancestors of people from Eurasia, people from Europe, people from East Asia. So, I mean, who exactly has the direct line of descent?
Well, and you also get the other issue, and this goes with the ancestors one maybe more than the first ones, is, I mean, a lot of the cultures that we're dealing with, and this goes to European history as well, are by definition prehistoric, as in there's no actual documentation. There is no, I can prove that this, my people, however you define that, were here first. Because, you're either relying on oral history, which has a whole bunch of problems with it, or again, there's little evidence besides archaeology, and someone was here, but you don't know who that someone was here.
I think the other problem with the argument from ancestry is that subsequent people have moved in. Like, if you say to me, oh, your ancestry is in Europe, so that's where you should be living, that's where you belong, that's where your land is, that mm-hmm. doesn't make any sense, because I grew up here.
Right. And you also have the difficulty of, unless someone is staying put on a given chunk of land, mm-hmm. is that the requirement for it being their land? I mean, many First Nation groups were migratory. In fact, most human groups were migratory. It wasn't until Mesopotamia that we actually settled down for a little while. So, I mean, how much time to put in before the land becomes yours?
True. And then, of course, that leads into, going with what Chloe was saying, right? I mean, everyone says, well, what are you? Well, I'm Canadian because I'm at least seven generations here. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't give me some stake, right? And then you go the varying weights, right? I mean, for example, Vancouver, right? Well, Vancouver is originally claimed by First Nations people. But it's arguable that First Nations people haven't actually lived in this territory that they're claiming for seven generations or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So how does this, statute of limitations aspect fit into it?
And to another extent, to How can we even justify ownership of land for our group just because of some sort of genetic ancestry to people who sort of were in this area before?
Right.
We haven't done anything particularly in that area. Like, so in the case of, to be controversial, Israel, if very few Jewish people had been there for a long time, what gave them the right to decide that just because of inheritance, suddenly every Jewish person is suddenly allowed to have Israel as their own land?
You know, and that goes along with something Ethan was saying, right? Because, I mean, even if we somehow said, okay, the Israelis have a claim to it because 2,000 or 2,500 years ago, there was the nation of Israel. Well, by their own history, of course, they had conquered that territory from the Canaanites and all that, right? So does that mean that they actually don't have a claim then to the land? Because they admit in their own, you know, history that they took it over from someone else, you know?
And I mean, getting to the point of putting time in, so to speak, I think it would be, most people would agree that, for example, if the government took, you know, your parents' land, you would have a legitimate claim to say that land is my family's heritage. But if it was, say, three generations or four generations or five generations in the past, when does your claim suddenly stop being relevant? Is there an actual number attached to this? Or are we just sort of saying, well, eh, whatever?
So basically, we have to pick an arbitrary line somewhere, right? There has to be some kind of decision.
But you have to be careful on that, too, because, I mean, we've been talking a lot about temporal sort of, you know, delineations. But in the 19th century of the United States, one of the big things was that the 1800s, whatever that is, what century that is. One of the big things that they had wasn't so much that there was a dispute onto who owned the land, as in who had first, that was there, whatever, was the fact that they weren't using the land, the idea of utility, right? Mm-hmm. So that if I own a huge stake of land, be it as a First Nations or whatever, or even as an individual, and the state sees a greater use to that land, it can expropriate that land for its own thing. And one of the things that Andrew Jackson promoted in taking over a lot of native territories in the United States was they weren't using it the way a white man would use it.
Yeah, right. This sort of, it goes back to John Locke and his basic argument for what constitutes property. He always focused more on the individual rather than the state. But for an individual to own property, you are mixing labor with land. Mm-hmm. So the basic argument against, let's say, native rights to land is that if they aren't cutting down the trees of an area and then planting stuff, they're not mixing any meaningful labor with the land, so they have no title over it.
Right. That's one of the issues that I wanted to discuss as well. This notion of working the land, does that actually imply ownership? By spending time and energy, you're making the land more valuable. And then historically, this is actually relevant because Native Americans were much better at making their land fertile than white Europeans were, which was actually one of the reasons why they kept taking the land, because it was far more valuable than the places that they had. The problem with this argument, though, is that it can't help us with land that's worthless. Deserts, Arctic, or inhospitable places. They may have strategic value, they may have minerals or gems or whatever there, but you can't really work the Arctic.
Also, just so you don't go into the ancestor fallacy, right? I mean, one of the things that working the land properly, the density that Europeans worked land was very different than what the First Nations did, which is one of the reasons why you'd sometimes get the appearance that they were better at working the land. It wasn't so much that they were necessarily better. They could have been, but there was not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of ancient cultures, both North America and not North America, of them being just as environmentally destructive. I mean, the Mayans, for example, the Aztecs, are famous for having destroyed the land because of their particular farming techniques. But well, that's a side note, man.
Yeah, the slash and burn technology is well, wouldn't characterize it as destroying, but it is a different way of doing things. The other aspect of sort of working the land is I guess what you could characterize as investing in the land. So maybe you built a house on it. Now, I mean, depending on if you were the first to build a house on it or not, but basically saying that we were the first to choose this particular land as our home. Now, I think that carries a bit of weight, but again, you sort of run into the problem of, well, how can you prove you're the first person to call this place home?
And to some extent, that works for individuals or family units, mm-hmm. but it doesn't necessarily work for society or states. So it'd be pretty hard to claim ownership of a huge amount of land for all people of a certain descent based off the fact that you put a few homes in it.
You know, and actually by your logic, I think Canada, we've got a great opportunity here because there are these things called national parks that the United States have. We could claim them because they don't do anything with them, right? We just got to cut down a few trees, put a house up there and say, hey, we now own this Yosemite Park is now ours.
And that is where force comes in and is really the ultimate decider of statehood.
Well, I'm not sure that's true anymore, though, and I think Don's about to disagree with you.
No. I was going to talk. We're bringing up interesting things and going back for Ethan's note. I mean, we first of all had, you know, this historical claim to it. Then there's economic claim to it, right?
Well, I mean, I think military is important to mention as well, because, again, the vast majority of human land gain / loss has been at the end of a gun or sword or bow and arrow. We assume that if you have the military strength to defend your land, then it's yours. So basically, might equals right. Now, this also comes from the point of view of the defender and the aggressor. We mentioned the Jews took Israel by force. But consider if you have, say, Daniel living on a plot of land with a gun, and Chloe decides to live nearby, you know, her living there might damage Daniel's security or status or something. So if she doesn't have a weapon, Daniel has the ability to keep her off the land. And you see this again with modern nation states policing their borders by force, keeping people out.
Now, going with what Chloe was going to say, I was going to interrupt. I will now interrupt and say, no! Actually, let's use your example. I mean, let's say Daniel has his property, right, and Chloe has her property next to it, and he, for some reason, doesn't like it or he wants the property. He just can't go over with a gun and say, this is now my property. We have something called law. And one of the interesting things, I'd say probably with some exceptions, up until the early 20th century, you're right, force was a very strong thing. But now we've replaced force, at least physical force, with economic force. So now if there are border disputes or conflicts, notably Taiwan is a great one, I think, for example, because Taiwan, according to mainland China, is just a province, and the Taiwanese say, no, we're independent. And China isn't people don't think, is going to actually use force to take back the island, but they are using a lot of political and economic strength. We were talking about before the show about how much land Canada has lost to the United States, and through no violence, but just, again, because of political and economic pressure that was applied to make these differences.
Yeah. Sure. When I said force, I didn't mean just military force. I meant, like, diplomatic pressure or economic pressure. So, yeah, I definitely agree with that. Modern diplomacy does not end in war or military shows of force as much as it used to. Although there is one notable exception recently. What was the country?
Nicaragua and Costa Rica.
Nicaragua put a bunch of its soldiers in land that's Costa Rica's. Costa Rica notably has no military. And then when a dispute started, Nicaragua was like, well, Google Maps says we own them. it actually did. Google Maps was wrong on this, and that was their justification for quite a while.
Invasion. Google Maps. Oops. Well, okay.
See, to completely disagree with what I said a few seconds ago, I think military force does play a role. Like in this example, I mean, obviously it doesn't as much anymore, but I think in this example we just had, the fact that Costa Rica had no army left it extraordinarily vulnerable
I mean, military force doesn't necessarily have to be active, though. I mean, consider, take the example of Canada and America. Who has military bases in Canada's Arctic? The U.S. does.
Russia, too.
Foreign powers have military installations in Canada. The Canadian soldiers are not allowed to go into. You know, like, if somebody is
responsible... We're just like Afghanistan and Iraq, then.
Well, if another nation is responsible for another nation's defense, what does that say about their sovereignty?
Well, you know, actually, and now I'm going to morph this, because there's another aspect of this which we've totally ignored. We've always assumed that we have borders and all that, right, in order to keep people out. Well, there's another aspect where it actually kind of keeps people in, right? Because, I mean, in order for you to leave the country, you need a passport or a visa or something like that, right? I mean, there's actually sort of two definitions. I mean, the United States right now is having a huge issue about trying to seal off its borders from immigrants, right? This isn't so much of a land dispute, but a people dispute. And that ultimately the land itself isn't really the issue. It's the people. And the land is just an arbitrator between them, right?
Well, I mean, going on to borders, because that's actually an important point. I mean, the funny thing with borders is that they're basically arbitrary. Depending on how you look at history, there wasn't modern, what we consider modern-day nation-states until, you know, sort of after the 30 Years' War in Europe, when you basically just sort of had these blobs that were kind of run because, you know, the king had the power, and then he, you know, gave a bit of it to, say, Don, who rented out his land to Chloe, who had an estate, and then, you know, next to Daniels, who had his hunting grounds, and that made up your borders. It was this decentralized, you know, sprawl, basically. It wasn't until after borders were established, some of them by treaties, which some of them are centuries old at this point, and, you know, it's hard to imagine why they still apply. In some cases, and they were also established under duress, so direct threat of war, or they were just established because, well, our army is still in your land, so, you know, I'm just going to draw the border like that. So, I mean, you have these international borders that are largely completely arbitrary.
You know, and it's even become more complex because, I mean, one of the things I had in my little notes here, right, is, I mean, borders are used, first of all, to say who gets to use or not use the land, right? Mm-hmm. But with the whole idea of globalization, right, I mean, right now, you know, a significant amount of Canadian corporations operating in Canada aren't actually Canadian. They're actually foreign-owned. And, I mean, so what does that actually mean to the whole idea of borders and all that? Do they still exist, right?
Well, I mean, you look at Europe. I mean, the idea of borders in Europe is kind of becoming a stupid term because you can crisscross across Europe as much as you want, and you're unlikely to ever show your passport. Try to cross the American border, and you need, like, six pieces of ID.
And don't forget to get the gropia.
Yeah, that's true. That's unfortunate. But getting sort of back onto treaties and countries, I mean, the funny thing with that is countries change management, you know, every now and then. And you have to wonder, like, some of these countries are no longer considered legitimate. You have monarchies or regimes like the Nazis, for instance, who sign treaties and define borders. They go out of style and, you know, people still have these treaties left over. At what point do they just become null and void?
Does this mean we can get rid of the Vatican because that was Mussolini's idea?
Well, actually, that's a good example. You also have, like, locally here in BC, Tommy Douglas made some treaties with local native groups. After Tommy Douglas left office, all those treaties were basically just ignored, wiped out, made void by the next government. So, I mean, current native land claims are based on treaties that have been, you know, crossed out.
Right, which again, like, maybe goes back to the whole idea of power or authority makes right. Whoever has the power and authority can arbitrarily, if they so wish, ignore whatever. Unless, of course, the native tribes, for example. I mean, one of the big things that's worked with native rights is trying to bring the International Court of Justice involved in this. So even if the Canadian government, for one reason or another, says, well, we don't recognize this, by bringing in an international body or a foreign government to apply the pressure that they themselves don't actually have, mm-hmm. is one way to help fight this Tommy Douglas sort of incident that you bring up, right?
Right. I mean, the interesting thing with native claims, at least in BC, is because they have Aboriginal title, meaning, and this is actually more, this is common law, it's not really written down, in theory they have a right to land even after the assumption of sovereignty and settlement belonging to another nation.
I thought the problem in BC was different, because I thought the British government, because we were British at the time, mm-hmm. signed treaties with most of the First Nations, up until about, you know, the Western and maybe BC, where there were no treaties actually ever signed. And that's one of the things that's having this difficulty, is that in an odd sort of way, the First Nations have a common law, British common law claim to the land. Mm-hmm. But they don't actually have a treaty title to it because there were never treaties ever made for those particular areas.
BC is a little different than the rest of Canada, but it just adds another layer of confusion because both the federal government and the BC provincial government and the native groups have to sign off on any agreement. So sometimes the federal government will say, this sounds good, but the province will say, no. Or the province will say, oh, this is, you know, a pretty good idea. And the federal government will be like, nah, I'm not going to do this.
And then, of course, you just mentioned another interesting thing, right? So we have BC,
yeah,
which is one piece of territory.
Yeah.
But we have, it's Canada.
Mm-hmm.
It's Canada slash BC. Mm-hmm. It's Canada slash BC, Haida Nation.
Sure.
Right? So, I mean, you know...
And don't forget, if, like, a city or municipality exists in there, too, you got even another layer.
Right. Yeah. So there's your ownership and your borders or another thing. And how do you determine who actually even represents that? I mean, that becomes another thing. Because you mentioned, in theory, Tony Douglas represented a government, right?
Mm-hmm.
But... how legitimate was that government ultimately being? And then, it, you know, as far as First Nations goes, there's a lot of ideas of authority. But on that note, I'm going to have to sign off early today, folks. I apologize for this, but duty calls. So I'm going to say eyes open, minds on, and try not to make too much noise. If you guys want to keep talking, or are you going to go to a commercial?
Let's go to a commercial break. We'll let Don slink away, and we'll be back with...
In shame.
Yes. We'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker after this.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now... hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle. Let the clatter kill him. Let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Stewie, hey.
Hey there. So, it's been 24 hours. Got my money?
Oh, you know what? Just give me till next Friday. I'll have it for you.
Oh, that's funny. I could have sworn I said have it today.
Yeah, I don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, well, all right then. That's good, OJ.
Ah!
Yeah, that hurt?
Ah!
That hurt?
What the hell?
Yeah, it feels so good, does it?
Ah!
No, huh?
Oh!
Yeah.
CITR would like to thank everyone who donated their time, love, and money to Fun Drive 2010. The money raised goes directly into the operating costs of keeping our station on the air. To thank you for your donation, we have prizes that are waiting for you here. If you have not yet picked up your prizes, now is the time. Come down to CITR World Headquarters in room 233 of the Student Union Building on UBC campus between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday to Friday.
You got till 5 o'clock. You hear me? You got till 5 o'clock.
You freaking psychopath!
Clean yourself up.
Pay your pledge. Get your prizes. It's that simple.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker.
And Chloe and I have our own microphones now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, finishing up our discussion of land ownership, I mean, we've kind of covered, I think, a pretty wide swath of information here. Everything from claims of ancestry and, you know, being the first one there, of working the land, of investing your energy, your blood, sweat, and tears type thing, to international borders and something, and sort of the arbitrariness of how they exist, as well as the conflict between having governments and dynasties that come into existence, go away, and then come back, and what happens to the agreements that they forge in the meantime. Obviously, we can't answer all these questions. I mean, this is a philosophical discussion and a branch of philosophy that has been debating this for hundreds of years.
Yeah,
and
there really isn't a right answer in any sense.
And really not. I mean, I think that what we can come up with for sure is that, property as a physical thing is not cut and dry. And that anytime you try to treat it cut and dry, I think you're asking for trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the question that we could have is do we want to have one set of property rules that apply to everybody on the planet, which, I mean, probably would invalidate a lot of land claims by Aboriginal groups. It would also probably make some serious questions about government land and taxation and all that sort of thing.
And even the notion of statehood itself.
Sure.
I think you could probably come up with a fairly wide agreement on what makes personal property, but I think what makes sort of what controls what's estates is going to be something that will be argued for eternity.
Sure. Until the day that, you know, all the states go away or something.
Yeah.
So again, I think a fascinating discussion, and I would, you know, be very curious to hear what our listeners take on this as well. So, I mean, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. In the meantime, while you're all emailing us, why don't we go to our skeptical highlights to wrap up today's show. On December 18th, CFI is presenting our last cafe inquiry of the year over at SFU Harbor Center. And the topic for this week will be, should we teach Santa Claus to our children? Is it harmless fun, or are we teaching them more fairy tales? Be sure to join us at 11 in the morning at SFU Harbor Center to discuss it. We are also encouraging people to bring unopened toys that can be donated to a local charity for children.
Are we telling those children that Santa brought them?
No, we're not.
Oh, how interesting.
We're going to say that Santa didn't bring them, that we brought them. Again, December 18th, 11 a.m. Of course, coffee and donuts will be there as well, so I encourage you to come by. And on December 21st, we have our last Skeptics in the Pub downtown, and that's, of course, at the Railway Club.
The last one ever?
No, just the last one of the year. Silly, the last one ever. No, of course not.
They will never end,
yeah.
As long as there's pubs and skeptics.
Pretty much, yeah. As always, a great time to socialize with other skeptics and freethinkers. In fact, there's going to be a special treat for this one. The ultimate skeptic fanboy, Fred Brimmer, has returned from Australia and will regale us with stories about Tam Oz and getting to hang out with James Randi and George Harab and everybody else that Fred knows personally. So come by December 21st, 7:30 Railway Club. It's going to be awesome.
Sweet.
Anything else?
Next week, we're probably going to talk more about WikiLeaks and about a lot of the questions surrounding whether it's a good thing for either the U.S. or the world, or whether it's a bad thing. So if you have any information you'd like to send us, or opinions you'd like heard on air, just send us an email.
Excellent.
And if you're interested, go to some of the mirror sites and check out the actual WikiLeaks archives. They're quite interesting.
Indeed. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, reminding you, please download our podcast on iTunes. Email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Visit our webpage, www.radiofreethinker.com, to read our blogs and to pick up the show notes. And, of course, follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. And thanks for listening.
I feel like I should say eyes open, minds on, because I'm sitting in Dawn's spot. So I'll say that. But it is Chloe. It's not Dawn.
And this is Daniel saying, don't drink and drive over the holidays.
Well, that's nice. That's a nice thing to say. Well, tune in next week, folks. See you later on Radio Freethinker.
Morning. Good day to you, sir. Hey, wait a minute. What the hell?
CITR would like to thank everyone who donated their time.